I heard you're a faggot that likes messing with little boys, he says, following it up with some spit. I heard they found some dead little boys in your house. That true faggot? How much? I reply. How much? What? You think I'm some faggot that's going to let you blow me? How much did they say they'd pay you to do this? Did they say they'd get you a lawyer, too? The fuck are you talking about? I'm Theo Cray. I hunt serial killers. I found one in Montana. I was just on the news because of the one I found in Los Angeles. His name is John Christian, and it turns out he's a CIA informant who's being protected by someone who wants me dead. Skinhead shakes his head. Jesus Christ. What the hell is that all about? He turns to the man in the corner, who is now a foot closer to me. You heard of this crazy faggot? Flat Top replies, I don't think he takes you seriously. Skinhead is in my face. You don't take me seriously, faggot? How about I make you suck my dick, faggot? I don't think either one of us wants that. I hope not. He grabs his crotch. What, my dick don't taste good enough to you? You need some little boy's dick? I wouldn't take that shit, Flat Top says to Skinhead. Show that faggot you're serious. Skinhead is getting himself worked up, but I realize he's not the one I need to worry about. Flat Top is the professional here. He's getting Skinhead angry, so he'll attack me. But Flat Top is the killer. He's military, maybe retired special forces, or some DevGru wet worker they called in. This is Georgia. It couldn't have been hard to find one. Professor Theo wants to turn to him and point out how transparent the tactic is. Someone called in an arrest on Skinhead. Skinhead is the patsy, so that after Flat Top bashes my skull into the ground, they'll have someone to take the blame. Skinhead can say all he wants that there was another man involved, but if he's the one they find covered with my blood, it's not going to matter. Skinhead is cracking his knuckles, getting ready to sucker punch me. I speak as calmly as possible. When they ask you what happened, just remember the name Oyo Diallo. That's the man they're protecting. That's who killed the children in Los Angeles and at the Sweetwater address. He's called John Christian here. Just remember that. They might make you a deal if they don't try to kill you like me. This breaks his concentration. It's also messing with Flat Top. I'm telling Skinhead the thing he was sent to keep quiet. Chances are, he has no clue what I'm talking about. Flat Top has stopped inching toward me for a moment as he thinks this over. Then, just like that, his concentration is back. It's like he's a Terminator that's just rebooted. If Skinhead doesn't do something in the next minute, he's going to start the fight himself. I have to wait for the right moment. I've got one crazy jailhouse neo-Nazi and a trained killer about to go for my throat, and my hands are still cuffed to the bars behind my back. As good as the instruction I've been getting from my MMA fighter student may be, it's all theoretical. Beyond that, I've only got one thing going for me, and if I fuck it up, I'm dead. You say some weird shit, Skinhead says, as he backs away. Flat Top knows now is the time to strike. Chapter 61. Paranoid. If I were where Flat Top's sitting, my most devastating form of attack would be to use my heavy boots for a kick to the head. In one move, he could knock me out and not worry about getting any bites or bruises from me. This is where I'm the most vulnerable, with my hands cuffed to the bars. His shoulders tilt to the side as he leans on his right leg, freeing up his left. Fuck. He's a martial artist. He's about to kick me in the head from where he's sitting. Now that Skinhead has backed off, I pull my legs in under the bench. I have to be ready to move fast. Once Flat Top knows what's going on, I won't get a do-over. He takes a deep breath, and one arm grips the bench to his right. I try not to watch with my eyes directly at him. I need him off guard. Skinhead is walking back toward me, deciding that he's going to go for it. There's a flash of movement to my right as Flat Top's powerful leg explodes toward my head. But I duck before the boot smashes through the air and slams into the bars. He has no idea how vulnerable he left himself. My arms whip in front of me in a fraction of a second as I lunge forward and my left hand stabs the open end of the handcuff into Flat Top's left eye socket before he can get his balance. He screams and flails at me with his hands. I get another punch in, this one to his right eye, cutting a gash over it. He falls to the floor, and I kick him in the head. His screaming stops. Behind me, Skinhead is looking confused. I swing my right arm around and connect the cuffs with the side of his head.
"Fuck no! Fuck no!"
he yells, with his hands up, pleading for mercy. I give him three fast punches to the temple, using the cuff as a brass knuckle, dropping him to the ground. He curls up in a ball and stops moving, stunned by the head trauma. I rush back to Flat Top and wipe the blood off the cuffs using his shirt. His breathing is labored as he lies there unconscious. He may or may not live, but he'll definitely never see out of that wreck of an eye. I back up to the bars and place the handcuffs just like they were before I picked them using the handcuff key I've kept on me since Joe Vick nearly took my life. It takes 10 minutes for the deputies to come to the cell. I don't know if this was planned or just really bad jail management. Skinhead has picked his head up off the ground and is leaning on the bench at the far end of the cell. The guards unlock the door and rush to Flat Top. One of them turns to me.
"What happened?"
"He attacked the other one, but he wouldn't have it." An older man in a suit pushes his way through the growing crowd of deputies. He singles me out.
"Who are you?"
"Theo Cray," I reply.
"The guy that found that murder house?"
"Yes."
"What the hell are you doing in here?"
I just shake my head.
"We had a mix-up," says a deputy.
"We thought there was a warrant for him, but there wasn't."
"So you put him in this jail cell with these animals?"
"Sorry," says the deputy. The suited man reaches behind me and unlocks the cuffs. When he pulls his hands away, there's blood on his fingertips, but he just wipes them off on his black slacks.
"This way, Dr. Cray," he says. "Watch the blood."
Two paramedics are working on Flat Top, trying to stem the flow of blood from his eye. I should feel some remorse, I guess, but all I can think is how much I wish he were Oyo. The man in the suit takes me gently by the arm.
"I'm so sorry you had to see that, Dr. Cray. My apologies. This isn't the kind of jail we run here."
I glance backward at Skinhead. A paramedic is putting gauze on his bloody temple. I don't need to worry about him. An unreliable witness works both ways. My primary concern is making sure my next strike happens before whoever was behind this gets to me again. Chapter 62. Confessional. When I get back to my hotel room, it's almost 4 in the morning. I spent the last several hours spilling my guts about everything. While I was vague about the means by which I found Oyo's fingerprints on the DHS doorknob, the police didn't seem bothered. In all, I spoke to 2 detectives from the Douglas County Sheriff's Department, an Atlanta FBI agent, and a Georgia Bureau of Investigation agent, while a recorder caught everything. They asked questions, but were still trying to figure out what the hell happened at that house at Sweetwater. Throughout our conversation, deputies would come in and slide them notes. At one point, I asked, "What's the body count right now?" An actual forensic investigation hadn't even started yet, but they were trying to quickly assess how serious the situation was. Sheriff Art Duane, the man in the suit who pulled me from the cell, replied,
14, and that's only what's poking out of the ground. One of the detectives asked me if I'd ever heard of anything like this, meaning how Oyo could get away with so many killings under the watchful eye of an indifferent government. At first my answer was no, but then I remembered the story of Andrei Chikatilo, the butcher of Rostov. He was active in the Soviet Union for more than 2 decades because the Communist Party didn't believe it was possible. They thought serial killers were a symptom of decadent societies like the United States, and moreover, they'd never have suspected one of their own party members. In Oyo's case, his handlers couldn't accept the fact that they'd enabled a monster to rape and kill so freely. Now they're so desperate to cover up this fact that they tried to have me murdered, or at the very least, shut up. I don't know if Flat Top was there to kill me. His goal may have been to put me in the hospital as a kind of warning. It's quite possible his beating wasn't going to involve the kind of maiming that I gave him. I'm glad I'm realizing this now and not then, because I would have hesitated and found myself with a wired jaw and mysterious woman sitting in the corner telling me this is what happens when I don't play along. Fuck her. Fuck them. Fuck Flat Top. I had every right to cave in his skull. This seething anger is what's helping me stay awake as I sit in my hotel room with my back to the wall and my eyes on the door. I even put pillows under my sheets in case Cold War Bill decides to sneak in and shoot me. I'm 99% sure that's not going to happen now. I've already spilled everything the local authorities need to know. Going after me now would only add credibility to my story. And my story didn't involve Cold War Bill, Mysterious Woman, or Flat Top. I kept them out because those are the kind of details that make me look crazy. I try to focus on what's most important. My rage is fueled by how they tried to fuck with me and the fact that Oyo is still out there. He's on the run, and I doubt they're helping him. If they are trying to assist, it's probably to set a trap. But he's too smart for that. I'm sure he had a backup plan if things went south. Part of that plan has to involve getting out of the country. Would he do that right now? I gave his description to the cops who showed up at the Sweetwater house. That probably went out to every state trooper within hours. People on the run try to either get as far away as they can or find some place where they can wait things out. Assuming the nursery was Oyo's only safe house in the Atlanta area, where would he go if he had to improvise? Checking into a motel would be the quickest way to get caught. Does he have an accomplice in the area that he could run to? Ms. Violet's assistant, Robert, was afraid of him, and I doubt Oyo would flee to his church. Where else, then? Maybe I already have the answer. I take out the map I made from the tracking data. There was one house that I had ruled out as his killing room, but it might be a place he'd run to if he needed to stay out of sight for a few days. It's the home in the nice suburb that belongs to the corporate attorney. While I can't see him willingly sheltering a fugitive, what better place for a wanted African war criminal to lie low than a waspy home in a rich neighborhood? Chapter 63. House Call. I pull up in front of the house in my rental car and hop out without a care in the world, holding on to a package like I'm here to make a delivery. Cars are starting to pull out of driveways as people head off to work. There's a Mercedes parked on the street near the mailbox, which seems odd, given that there's plenty of driveway space in front of the 2-story home. Made from gray stone and set atop a small green hill, the house was probably the model home builders showed to sell the neighborhood. I walk up the steps and knock on the door. Through the glass on the side, I can see a rug, a staircase, and the light coming through a glass door on the other side of the house. No one answers. It could just be a wild hunch, but I'm not ready to drop it and tell the cops to come check on the house, which maybe I should have done in the first place, but now I'm in hunter mode. I go back down the steps and peer through the glass window at the top of the garage door. There's a Volvo station wagon and a dark blue Toyota Corolla with tinted windows parked inside. One of these clearly doesn't belong. I also spot something else suspicious, a big bag of dog food. There are three cars here, but evidently the pooch is the only one that had to go to work. I walk back up to the front door and ring the doorbell. I know full well that he's not going to answer. He probably suspects that I'm a cop trying to see if there's anyone inside. I peer through the side window again and catch sight of what might be blood on the staircase. Scratch that. A house this immaculate, it's got to be blood. There's not a lot. It doesn't look like Oyo just blew the lawyer's brains out when he answered the door. Oyo might have the man and his wife tied up in a bedroom closet, waiting to see if he needs them as hostages. It's what I would do. Since kicking in the door isn't an option, I need another plan. I flirt with the idea of calling the fire department and seeing what would happen if a fire truck came racing to the house next door. Then I realize that Oyo is definitely the kind of guy who would shoot his hostages before leaving a party. I go back to my car. As I climb inside, I'm positive I spot movement in an upstairs window of the house. There. The curtains moved again. He's in there. No doubt about it. As I pull away, I catch a glimpse of something in the backyard through the slotted fence. A children's playhouse. Damn it. I park just around the corner. In my rearview mirror, I notice that the house has the perfect view of cars coming toward it. The other end of the street is a dead-end loop. Oyo is sitting upstairs in the master bedroom, watching to see who is approaching. I should call the cops, but I know he's not the negotiating kind, and if I spooked him, he might be minutes away from leaving, which means killing the homeowners. I race around the houses that border the backyard and come up the other side, opposite from where I was before. Peering over the backyard fence, I see a wooden staircase leading to a wooden deck. This was what I saw through the front door. To the left and over is a small balcony attached to the master bedroom. The drapes are pulled tightly shut, except for a small gap at the top. They appear to have been pinned. This is how he watches the road that leads up to the house from behind. Call the cops, Theo. They'll send a patrol car. Maybe they'll roadblock him, but they'll want to contain him first. He'll know they're coming. I move to the side of the fence, not visible from the bedroom. I need to get to the deck, but I can't do that while he's watching the backyard. There has to be some other distraction that doesn't involve a siren and dead hostages. Shit. There is. There's actually an app for that. Chapter 64. Sharing Economy. I take out my phone and order an Uber to the house across the street from where I'm standing. This is a terribly unethical thing to do to the driver, but I'd like to think he'd agree to do it if we had the chance to discuss what's at stake. The 8 minutes it takes for him to arrive feel like 80. As his icon rounds the corner, I can hear the sound of his tires rolling up the incline. I'm sure Oyo is watching, too. I wait for the car to reach the far side of the house. Then I climb over the back fence. I wait another moment for the car to come to a stop in front of the home, directly in front of Oyo's other window. I text the driver, "Running late. I'll be 5 minutes. Start the meter." He texts back, "No problem." I feel a twinge of guilt, but bury it as I slide around the house and start to creep up the deck stairs, trying to keep my back as flat to the wall as possible. I finally reach the sliding glass doors and poke my head around inside, making sure that Oyo isn't getting a glass of orange juice in the kitchen. The inside is empty. except it's not. There's a figure standing at the front door, peering out into the street through the glass window. Oyo. Fuck. This was not my plan. I stand back, aim my gun through the glass door, and point it directly at him. Neuroscientists say they can predict an action our mind has decided to take moments before our conscious mind has even decided what we think we're going to do. The function of consciousness, they argue, isn't to make decisions, but to rationalize them after the fact. It's our brain's way of explaining why we did things, a kind of public relations office that turns our id into a rational actor, and not some lizard monkey acting out of fear. I would argue that my actions were based on a rational calculus. I weighed the risks and decided on the best solution. If you'd asked me a minute ago if I were a killer, I wouldn't have known for sure. My reaction to Flat Top and Skinhead would have been some indication, but even when I faced down Joe Vick, I was still looking for some other option besides proactive self-defense. I scream his name. Oyo! He spins around. I squeeze the trigger twice. The first bullet shatters the glass door, but, given the reality of physics, takes a slightly altered path, rather than the direct one from my muzzle to his forehead. It's the second bullet that I fired that goes straight. Straight into his head. His neck whips back, and he falls to the ground as hundreds of shards rain down in front of me. I step into the home, gun pointed forward, and approach his body. There's a pistol in his waistband. I reach down and grab it, tucking it into mine. It'll be much easier to convince the cops that it was in his hand when I saw him and that I took it from him after. Not that they will care. I check for a pulse, just to make sure that the bullet actually did wipe out his brains and it's not just a bad scratch. He's dead. I move up the staircase with my gun still drawn. He's had accomplices in the past. The door to the master bedroom is open. Inside, two bodies lie on the bed, the lawyer and his wife in their bedclothes. His throat is slit, and hers is dark purple. I check the closet. Empty. I move down the hall and see a small doll lying in the middle of the carpet. The first door is a little girl's room. I sweep inside and open the closet. Just clothes. I move down the hall to another doorway. This is also a little girl's room. I sweep it. Also empty. I move down to the end of the upstairs and come to a bathroom door. I push it open and see two blurry shapes lying in the bathtub behind a frosted curtain. They're not moving. My feet feel like lead, but I have to check. I step onto a frilly pink rug and stand directly in front of the curtain. With my left hand, I grab the edge and yank it away. Two pairs of frightened eyes stare up at me. Tearful eyes. Alive.
Chapter 65. Closure. Sheriff Duane is sitting next to me on the curb as law enforcement officials tape off the house and go over every square inch. He's keeping me company, just like I did the traumatized little girls while we waited for the police to arrive. Their names are Connie and Becca. They were scared because they couldn't understand why Mr. Christian was so angry. They'd never seen him like that. They still didn't know that their parents were dead. God help the person who has to tell them that. I finally left their side when a female cop with a soothing voice came into the bathroom. I then let the deputies escort me out of the house and into the front yard, where they bagged the guns I had on me and did their due diligence getting swabs from my hands. Sheriff Duane arrived within 20 minutes. After he took an assessment of what happened inside, he sat down next to me to get my story. Thankfully, nobody put me in handcuffs.
So you had a hunch he'd be here?
asks Duane. More or less. I knew he had business with the lawyer. I thought it might be a likely spot.
And you didn't think about calling it in?
There's only a touch of recrimination in his voice.
Sheriff, people like you never take my hunches all that seriously.
You'd think that would change by now, he replies. But I can see your point.
There's also the fact that I don't know who I can trust. You ever find out why I ended up handcuffed with those two animals last night?
Nope. And I can't find out why federal marshals checked the big one out of a hospital this morning and took off with him in an out-of-town ambulance. Fact is, I can't even find his arrest report.
Mysteries, I reply.
Yep. Like how so much blood ended up on the inside of your handcuffs.
His eyes dart over to me.
You should run a cleaner jail.
Maybe. Maybe.
He points a thumb at the house behind us.
How about this crime scene? How clean is that going to be?
Oyo's prints are on his gun.
They should be, or someone else tucked it into his pants.
Good. And I can tell the bullet went through the front of his head, so that makes things easier.
And if it hadn't?
I'd make sure you had a lawyer right about now.
I've been asking myself what I would have done if Oyo didn't have a gun. Would I have still shot him? Would I have then tried to cover that up? Ethically, I tell myself, I would have been fine with ending him, even though only circumstantial reasons led me to the house. And that's where it gets sticky. In principle, vigilantism is a horrible idea. There's a reason why we have courts and thresholds for evidence. As much as the aftermath proves that I made the right choice, I tell myself not to be so arrogant. This wasn't as clear-cut as it now appears to everyone.
Duane looks down the street as news trucks start to roll up.
Here come the buzzards. We've already got a small carnival at Sweetwater Road.
He shrugs.
At least we have closure.
Do we? You heard my story about how I found Oyo. We don't have closure.
We have the normal kind, son. The kind you're talking about, I don't think that's on the table.
You know there's no way he did all this without some folks straining their necks to look the other way.
Yeah. But this isn't going to be my problem.
Maybe not. So when do I get my gun back?
He chuckles. You're from Texas. You might want to get a replacement. This one's going to be in evidence for a while.
I nod to the crime scene van.
But you and me, we're good?
I reckon. Unless the FBI shows me videotapes of you and Mr. Oyo dancing around in your birthday suits together, laughing it up about the prank y'all gonna pull. We're good.
He leaves me on the curb. A detective approaches me and politely offers me a seat in his unmarked car so I can go back to the station and make a statement. I ask if I can sit in the front seat so the reporters don't get wind of the fact that I just showed up at another crime scene when we pass by them. The detective obliges, and, for the second time in 24 hours, I let the police drive me off. It's become frighteningly routine for me. All I can think of are the scared little girls and what led to this. Oyo may be over, but this isn't. They've already fucked with my life several times, and I suspect that even if I run my mouth off to the press and anyone else who will listen, I may get more visits from ghosts before I have a chance to tell my story to someone who can make a difference. If I really want to end this, I may have to make a compromise I never wanted to make.
Chapter 66. Response. Never believe anything that's reported in the first 24 hours. In the age of social media, this is especially true. People are so quick to rush to Facebook or Twitter with their hot take on whatever headline just flashed across their screen
that they don't even bother reading the article or waiting to find out if it's confirmed. Watching the Toy Man story unfold is fascinating. I have the news on in my hotel room as correspondents rush to Sweetwater Road to uncover the second gruesome house of horrors to be discovered. What are the odds that there would be two serial killers uncovered in such a short span of time, they muse. Are we in a new age of super serial killers? Well, I wouldn't call it a new age. And second, I remark to myself, wait until they find out the twist. As soon as I got back to my room and bothered to turn on my phone, I found dozens of messages. Detective Chen called me 6 times, desperate to find out what was going on in Atlanta. Apparently, local officials here are too busy trying to figure out what the hell all this is to brief other law enforcement agencies. The LAPD is going to be in a particularly hot spot, because they effectively closed the case on the Wimbledon house, calling Ordavo Sims the primary suspect. If they plan to stick with that narrative, they're fucked. Because John Christian / Oyo Diallo was from California, and even had his car from there here, the FBI is on this case now, which means they're going to be revisiting every witness in Los Angeles, especially Artis. I'll be real curious to see what happens when they find out what kind of pressure was put on him. Plus, there's the fact that there was another set of fingerprints at the Wimbledon house. I'm guessing they belong to Oyo. Chen and company are going to look really, really bad over the one that got away. I'd gloat if this were office politics, but lives were lost. Hopefully the kid from the nursery isn't going to have too much trauma. I'm not so sure about the girls in the bathtub. Their frightened faces are going to stay with me. I've seen terror in the rigor mortis expressions of the dead, and even felt some of my own, but to be in the moment, to be right there, affects a different part of me. I understand even more how people like Joe Vick and Oyo can function. That part of a healthy human that feels empathy and wants to ease the pain of someone suffering in front of them, they don't have. Or worse, they get off on it. Something else I've noticed was the strong scent of death in Oyo's kill rooms and Joe Vick's victims. The part of the brain that processes chemicals like oxytocin, which helps us feel empathy, is related to our olfactory senses. I've heard anecdotally about correlations between serial killers and peculiar olfactory functions, but I wonder if there might be something more to it. Personally, I feel it's dangerous to start naming genes that serial killers have in common. It could quickly become a horrible new kind of profiling and lead to authorities ignoring outliers. But there might be something to studying the idea of which variations can lead to that kind of behavior. It may not be as simple as, if this is broken, then you're a killer. Instead, it may be more like a diagram of which intersecting mutations can lead to that behavior. There's a knock on my door. I grab my pepper spray and move quickly to the threshold, but before I can check through the peephole, I notice an envelope on the floor. By the time I realize it's not a hotel bill, whoever left it is no longer in the hallway. I open the envelope and find myself staring at a photocopy of an arrest report. It describes a black male who was arrested on suspicion of attempted murder of a minor he was accused of sexually molesting. The name is Scott F. Quinlan, but the face is Oyo's. Well, damn. The report is from 2005 and was made by the Baltimore Police Department. I'm on my phone 2 minutes later, calling to get the full file. It takes an hour to find out that no such case is in the system. Well, double damn. Who dropped this on my door? I do an internet search for Scott F. Quinlan and come up with nothing. I try 2 of the research portals I use to find Oyo, and still it comes up blank. Finally,
I look up the name of the arresting officer and get a number.
"Hello?" says a man with a gruff Baltimore accent.
"Is this Officer Kimberly?"
"Sergeant Kimberly. Who may I ask is speaking?"
"My name is Theo Cray. I have a question about a case."
"Are you a cop?"
"No, I'm an independent investigator."
"What the hell is that?" he replies, clearly short of patience with me.
"You see the story on the news about the house in Los Angeles with all the dead bodies?"
"Yeah? You have something to do with that?"
"Well, I found them. I'm here in Atlanta. Maybe you heard about that."
"Something? What do you need?"
"Could you pull up a website and look at the photo of the suspect?"
"Hey, guy, I'm in the middle of dinner. Can this wait?"
"Trust me. Just do it."
"Hold on." A minute later. "Fuck. Those motherfuckers."
"I take it you recognize that man."
"No fucking kidding. I pulled that piece of shit in after the kid's mother came running out to my squad car. He was two blocks away, washing down his van without a fucking care in the world. Arrogant prick said that he had diplomatic immunity or some shit like that, which he didn't. But apparently, he had something just as good. We book him, get the statement from the kid, even get a rape kit. A couple hours later, some assholes from the State Department show up, saying they have to put him under their custody. Our captain wasn't having any of that. Next thing you know, they're sending in their lawyers, and fuck all. We're like, you take care of him. When I tried to follow up on the case, there was no docket. Nothing. They just whisked him off, and the prosecutors declined to prosecute. Fucking weasels. I cornered one of them at the courthouse after I was on the stand for something else. I asked her how the hell they let that one slide. Know what she said? It was a domestic dispute that got out of hand. A fucking domestic dispute. A little boy gets raped, and that monster tries to stab a blade between his ribs so he won't go tell anybody. Prosecutor somehow decided that never happened. Fuckers.
He takes a deep breath.
Jesus. Looks here like they shot that asshole. Good fucking riddance. Wish I could thank whoever did that.
You just did, I reply.
Fucking serious?
Yep.
Well, good. People may give you shit, but you did the world a good thing. Anything I can do for you?
Yes, actually. Oyo killed a lot of kids after he was let go. While I don't think the people who got him out expected he would do that, they didn't seem to put too much thought into the matter.
No shit.
I need a name of one of the feds. Somebody you might have remembered.
Jeez, that's going back. Like I said, the folks came from the State Department. But I'm not sure if they knew who the fuck he was. They were just flax.
Probably. But the suspect must have talked to someone to get him out.
Yeah. Can I call you back? Maybe I got something.
I sit by my phone waiting for his call. Half an hour later, he rings me back.
Okay, this is all I can get. We keep a log of incoming and outgoing calls. While we can't listen in, it's legal for us to track who somebody called. One of our detectives has a database, and it started a couple years before then. It doesn't list the name of who placed the call, but I know when they let that asshole make his call. So this is the number.
He reads it off to me. I type it into a search engine. I check the number twice to make sure it wasn't a mistake. I'd been expecting some line to the CIA or the State Department. This is something else. This is the smoking gun.
Did you look this up?
Yes.
Right before I called you. Ain't that a peach? And it's the direct line.
Damn, I reply.
Good luck on that one.
No shit.
Chapter 67. Room Service. I sit back on the hotel bed, fully dressed, check my watch, and decide I have time to call Jillian.
"Is this the elusive Dr. Theo Cray?" she says, after picking up the phone.
"Still elusive. Before I tell you what I've been up to, tell me something about your day."
"Ha! All right. From the news, I can tell you that it's not as exciting. Carol and Dennis got an offer on the diner.
Carol and Dennis are her dead husband's parents. Jillian took over running their Montana restaurant after serving in the army. When I met her, I could tell her heart wasn't in the place, and she was ready to move on, but her love for them was too strong to ever let them know.
Are they going to take it?
My interest is a little selfish.
I think so. Carol and I have been selling a lot of pies, and I think I'm going to help her spin that off into its own thing.
Oh, that's cool, I reply.
Yeah.
Say it, Theo. Say it. You know, Texas could always use more pie.
Oh, really?
Maybe you come back down and let me help you test recipes?
I'll consider it, she says.
There's a warmth there. Please do. There's just one catch.
Another serial killer?
No, not quite. I may be spending the rest of my life inside a federal prison, or worse.
Worse? She asks.
I made someone very upset. He's in full ass-covering mode and may or may not be trying to get me renditioned to some black box prison in the middle of nowhere.
Fuck, Theo. Tell me what I need to know. I'm not going to let them do that.
There is nothing warmer to a man's heart than the woman he loves telling him she's ready to sneak behind enemy lines and rescue him. Don't go G.I. Jane just yet. I'm working on a solution. A little bird told me that I may be called to some secret intelligence agency court, where what they really do is put a gag order on everything and detain you preemptively.
What can you do?
I hear the sound of a key in a lock.
Gotta run. If you don't hear from me again, I blurt out, I love you,
before she can respond. I pocket the phone as an older man with receding red hair steps into the room. Still sweating through his gym clothes, he stares at his key and then looks at me, confused.
I think this is my room, he finally says.
When did you know about Oyo?
The man, Senator Hank Thurow, head of a House Counterintelligence Committee and capable of green-lighting black ops budgets in the hundreds of millions of dollars with the stroke of a pen, glares at me. Then the realization dawns.
You're that professor, asshole. You're so goddamn dead. I'm going to have you buried in a hole, then lose the hole.
When did you know about Oyo? I repeat. When did you know what he really was? I know for certain that by the time Oyo grabbed the kid in Baltimore, Thurow was fully aware of what this man was and didn't care. In fact, I have evidence that Thurow, who personally pushed to make Oyo an informant, did everything he could to protect the man, because exposing him meant damaging his own reputation. Thurow looks around the room suspiciously, searching for a camera or recording device.
I don't know what the fuck you're talking about, he says,
then turns for the door. I could have predicted as much. There's no way in hell he'd ever confess to any connection. But it doesn't matter. The people that kept him in power, the recipients of that funding, the former politicians turned lobbyists and contractors, realized he was a liability. I made a deal. I'm not happy about it. Kavanaugh is getting his terrorist profiling lab from me, and I get Thurow. It's a devil's bargain. I rationalize to myself that I'll be able to do some good on the inside, but deep down, I fear that's what everybody thinks before they go down the slippery slope and start using phrases like collateral damage in order to sleep at night. Thurow collapses before his hand can reach the door. I'd coated the outside door handle with a contact poison that knocks you out in small doses. Senator Thurow, his pores wide open from a workout in the hotel gym, got the full effect. While he dozes, I take out a bottle of sanitizer and spray every surface, ensuring that no trace of me remains. I'm done by the time the expected knock comes at the door. With latex gloves on, I open it and wipe down the exterior doorknob while two men wait alongside a wheelchair. I give them a thumbs up, and they load Thurow's unconscious body onto the seat and strap him upright. They head for the service elevator as I step to the stairs. When I cast a backward glance, I catch William Bostrom's eye as he and Mathis push Thurow through the door. We exchange knowing nods, aware that this won't really end the pain, but killing monsters never does. It's just something you have to do when you see them for what they are. When I reach my rental car parked 3 blocks away, I see a familiar figure leaning against the side, sipping coffee from a paper cup. "Let me guess, you're here to tie up loose ends?" I say to Cold War Bill, only half-joking as my left hand cradles a small canister, while my right goes to my side, ready to pull the pistol tucked into my back belt. He rolls his eyes and makes a groan. "That's not how it works. It's easier and less messy to just buy somebody off, which is what I think we did." I can't tell if there's a little bit of recrimination in his voice, or just a general bitterness at the world. He continues, "I'm here to make sure nothing gets fucked up. Do you trust your people?" "Not one bit," I reply. "But I trust their self-interest." "Right answer. One more question, just for my benefit. Why?" I look back in the direction of the hotel. It seemed like the most efficient way to eradicate the vector that made Oyo possible. Bill strokes his chin, nodding. "Okay, Professor. So it's all just biology to you? And mathematics. Don't forget the mathematics." Bill mutters, "God damn. I think you scare me more than Oyo. I'm just following things to their rational conclusion." "That's what scares me. How long before you decide people are the problem and cook up some kind of killer bacteria to wipe us all out?" "A bacterium would be an inefficient way to do that." I glance down at the small canister I'm holding in my fist. "Now, a designer prion." Bill looks down at my hand, then stares at me for a long moment, trying to tell if I'm kidding. "Shit. Now I don't know who should be more worried about this deal you struck. You or them?" Which is exactly what I want them to think. Cold War Bill tosses his half-finished coffee into a trash can as he shuffles off, probably trying to decide how to warn his superiors that Professor Cray might actually be some deranged, genocidal maniac plotting the apocalypse. I pocket the cylinder and get back into my car and head for the highway, unconcerned with Thurow, Bill, or his bosses. I have a lab to build. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Looking Glass by Andrew Main, performed by Will Dameron. Performance copyright 2017 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc., all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number: 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.